Good evening. I'm Roger. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Roger.
Ed did something. He told you my home group. I've been sober since October 11th, 1978. My home group's Bridge to Shore, and I have a sponsor, and I'm sponsored. I used to hear people say that kind of stuff, and I was in the back of the room always. And I just thought, what is this, your AA license plate? What? You know, what do I care? You know, and I say it when I talk because I want to convey three things. One, that continuous sobriety is possible. Two, when I tell you I've got a home group, it tells you that I've made a commitment to be somewhere at a specific time and place on a regular basis. And when I tell you I have a sponsor, it tells you that even though I've been sober a long time, I still know enough not to trust my thinking. And so I have someone I run my stuff by, especially when I'm really enamored with my stuff. And Dustin and I were talking before the meeting about that. It's interesting how you do this stuff in your head, and it sounds so good, and it makes so much sense. And then when you say it out loud to someone, usually your sponsor, but not always, and they look at you and go, did you hear what you just said? And it's like, oh, it's different when it comes out. It made a lot more sense when it was inside. Last week we talked about the fellowship and some of the elements of the fellowship, and I talked a lot about myths that the fellowship is enamored with, and I left out two. One is relapse is a part of recovery. That's not true. It's not true. I know some of the places people get that idea, but when you sit with me and you say, oh, I see this all the time. Guys come to me and say, I'm coming up in 90 days. I always drink it 90 days. Really? And what are you going to do? Well, I'll drink and I'll get all messed up and then I'll go back to treatment. Really? Interesting. So you know you're going to drink. How do you know you can get sober again? And our book talks about this. It says a lot of us did relapse. Some of us did. And they say, their phrase is, a good case of the jitters is good if you get full knowledge of your condition. So a lot of the guys I work with are chronic relapsers until they get to the steps. And sometimes it takes a while. I worked with a guy who was a chef, and when I met him, he was living in his car dying of pancreatitis. He could not stay sober. And we started doing the steps, and he'd get 2-3 months, and then he'd drink. You get 2-3-4 months, and then he drink. And he was so getting so discouraged. And I sat with him. I said, listen, man, the truth is, this year, you've only drank a total of 12 weeks. That's progress. Let's just keep growing these sober periods until these drunken periods disappear. And that's what was his experience. Eventually, he got it. But the deal was, when he came back, it was always, okay, let's look at what you did, but let's also look at what you weren't willing to do. And now let's say, are you willing to change any of that? If the answer is no, then we're done talking, because I can't help you if you're not willing to change something that has already proved to be insufficient. But if you're willing to change some of those things, let's try this again. And as long as the person is willing to make the effort and to change, you got a shot. The other one that just drives me nuts is drug of choice. Oh, alcohol's my drug of choice. Oh, really? God, if alcohol was my drug of choice, I would have chosen not to drink it. Alcohol is my drug of no choice. That's what alcohol is. It's my drug of no choice. Drug of choice puts the idea in my head that I have some say about it. No. Not here. Do that in your, wherever you do that. But don't do that here. That's poison. It's a lie. It's not true. Everything in our text, in our big book, says that's not our drug of choice. That's what we're powerless over. Have no choice. I've lost the ability to predict what's going to happen when I drink, when I'm going to drink, how long I'm going to drink. I got drunk on 2 drinks, and I blacked out for 3 days. Then I drank for a whole day, and I couldn't get drunk. So, I'm done. We got to do some steps. Maybe. So the point of this exercise is we've been talking about different messages. And the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters, which comprises a little over 30% of what we call the instructions, the first 164 pages, over the first one-third of it is dedicated to the first two steps. And they're not anywhere in the book. They describe a surrender, but nowhere does it say, now you've taken your first step. Oh, and here's your second step. It doesn't say that at all. What it wants me to do is it wants me to conclude from comparing their experience, which they wrote in the book, to my experience. They want me to come to my own conclusion, which is one of the great aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous. It never tells me what I am. It says, this is what we were. Are you like that? Well, then maybe you're one of us. That's all it does. It says, here's our experience. Do you have anything that compares to that? Because I'm the one. I am the one who determines whether I'm alcoholic or not. Not the court, not my wife, not the judge, not my counselor, not my sponsor, nobody but me. And I do that by comparing my insides with their insides, which they put in this book. So we talked a lot about the doctor's opinion, physical allergy, mental obsession, phenomenon of craving. Then they give us Bill's story, prototypical drunk. What a beautiful story. Every aspect of being a drunk is in his story. I mean, he was so messed up, so beautifully messed up. I like in the front of his story, it's talking about how he had this insatiable drive to succeed, you know, and came out of the war experience, and he looked around and he said, where is it happening? It looks like it's happening here. I'll go here, and I'll prove to the world I'm somebody. And that whole thing in the world of psychology, it's called external referral. This whole idea, I've got this image of me, and when I can get it out here and it looks right, the right amount of money, the right woman, the right house, whatever your picture is, when I get that picture, I'll know I'm okay. And Bill demonstrated beautifully. So he goes in, what does he do? I think a law course. Yeah, that's what I mean. Law course, yeah. And at the end, he talks about being too drunk to write or think, which is fairly drunk for a social drinker. And you know, for a guy that just tips him back once in a while. But he came to a conclusion that we have done, I don't know about you, I have done dozens and dozens of times, if not hundreds of times. Remember, he gets to the end of that and he goes, you know, about the time I finished that course, I realized the law was not for me. Why? Because Bill told himself he was going to feel complete. He was going to be somebody. He was going to be whole when he attained that goal. And the instant he got to the goal, he didn't say, oh, I should inventory this. He didn't say, there must be something wrong with me. He said, there's something wrong with the picture. Why? Because it didn't fix me. It didn't fix me. And so he was just on this merry-go-round of trying to fix what we call the God-sized hole. Every alcoholic talks about having this sense of being incomplete, not whole. And we go out here to fill the hole. And it never fills the hole. And we will do it until we die unless something happens along the way to change our path. So Bill's going along. And we see all the progression of his drinking. And then when it's really getting bad, he shows up in the hospital, which is where he meets Silkworth. And Silkworth gives him this idea. I think you're one of those allergic types. He says, what's that about? And he tells him. He says, that idea appeals. That explains a lot. I have an allergy. Great. And Bill goes, thanks. I'll take it from here. And Bill did what all of us do at different times. Self-knowledge will be the answer. Self-knowledge. So Bill now has got information. He's got his resolve, which he fails to see is ineffective with his drinking. That's what we call delusion. Now he's got this resolve. I'll just reassert myself, and now I've got this information. I have an allergy, so I'm done. And then, of course, he's not, and he gets drunk, and it's worse because it always gets worse. He shows up in the hospital again, and he hears Silkworth talking to his wife. And he's saying, you know, Bill's one of those guys, I'm sorry, Lois, but Bill's one of those guys that I've come to regard as hopeless. Really, what's that look like? Well, that means he's going to either be up in the psych ward in a diaper, or he's going to die in withdrawals. I'm paraphrasing. Well, some of you might not have read the book. You know, I don't want you to think that I'm quoting the book. But I'm quoting, in essence, the story. Bill hears this and goes, holy shit, I don't like that future. And so he goes back. Now he's got a two-part program, self-knowledge and fear. And he goes, that's not going to happen to me. I'll reapply myself, more resolve, and new information. I got the information about the allergy, and now I got this piece. I'm scared to death. I don't want to end up like that. There was no happy ending at the end of that, so I'm not going there. So that's his formula for staying sober. Works for a while. And anyone in this room who's done this knows, after it works for a while, you start thinking, maybe it wasn't such a big deal. Perhaps I overreacted. You know? He gets drunk again, and this last bout is when he runs into Abby, and his buddy shares some new ideas with him. And he has a pretty profound experience while he's drinking, talking to Abby. We talked about this last week a little bit. And out of that, he goes, damn, you know, Abby's hooked himself onto something that really works, and da-da-da-da. He ends up in the booby hatch again. Oh, I mean the hospital. And he does the instructions that Abby gave him about surrendering to God, acquainting a fellow who is Abby with his defects of character, and turning himself into the restitution and the service phase. And some powerful things happened to him in the hospital. The thought came to him, now, I don't know if you can remember your last detox, but I can. And this was not one of the thoughts that came to me. The thought that came to him while he was in the hospital detoxing was, you know, perhaps there are thousands of men like me out there who would like what I have. That is not what I did coming out of my detox. Evidence of a huge shift in his consciousness, in a huge shift in the way he was looking at this. They're doing this for us to identify. Have you ever tried staying sober on fear? There is no consequence in the world if you're a real alcoholic. There is no consequence in the world in front of you that can stop you from drinking. It can interfere with it for a while, but it cannot stop you. It cannot stop you. I had a diagnosis of fatal chronic acute alcoholism. It didn't stop me. I welcomed it. I've sat in court with guys, and the judge says, hey, you're going to the workhouse for a year, or you might want to treat that alcoholism. And he turns around, looks at me, and goes, what should I do? Because why? Because AA says, here's your experiment. If you want to know if you're an alcoholic, try some controlled drinking. Oh, try some controlled sobriety. Try, like, not drinking for a year. Right. What's controlled drinking look like? could we try some of that first? Because that's the only way I'm going to get in front of the fact that I don't have control. The only thing that's going to put me there in front of that idea is my experience, not yours, mine. So they lay it out in the book, right? So the next thing after Bill's story is there's a solution. Oh, if there is, let's just get at it. And there is a solution. I wrote some things down. It's all about your thinking. It's not about drinking. After Bill's story, we're not talking about drinking. Everything is about your thinking. It's all about thinking. And then it talks about different types of drinkers, and it gives us this conclusion, like on the 23rd bloody page. If you missed the paragraph in the preface, more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. We put it in here again. And their conclusion is, their conclusion is that the main problem of mine, the alcoholic, centers in my mind rather than my body. So where am I at with that question? Where am I at with that question? Do I really think it's in my mind? Do I really? Not really. No, I don't think so. It's a nice idea, but I don't see how that's going to pay any bills. The main problem's in my mind. We can prove that. If you're an alcoholic and you have the phenomenon of craving, we can prove that very simply. We got 4 ounces of whiskey here, and it's not a problem until it's in here. Because I can't have the phenomenon of craving until the alcohol's in my system. So everything that feels like jonesing for a drink is obsession. It's mental obsession. Because you can't have the phenomenon. You can't have a craving until the substance is in my body. So, if the problem lies in the drink exclusively, I'm not drinking, I should have no problem. But I have this mind. Bill's story illustrates it beautifully, and every story in this room would do the same thing. I'm just not drinking today. And then by 3 o'clock, I'm shit-faced. I changed my mind. I didn't know my buddy's going to show up with 2 cases of beer. Hell, you know, it's free. What do you expect? I mean, you know, I just changed my mind. Now, I had no defense against the thought. It doesn't occur to me that I have no defense against the thought because I like the idea, because I'm an alcoholic. Of course I'd like a drink. Roland had the same experience. He comes back from a year with Jung, and he's really feeling good. He was really confident, a lot of self-knowledge, a lot of insight, workings of the mind. This is beautiful. There's only one problem. Someone asked the wrong question. What was that? Well, he's on the boat going back to New York. Would you like a drink? Yes. Of course. It's been a year. I'm very thirsty now that you bring it up. Had no defense against the idea. Had no defense against the idea. And once I succumb to the idea, I drink. Then the phenomenon of craving kicks in, and I go through the stages of spree. And if I live through it, I come out the other end, and we always go, oh, I need a break. I'm taking a little hiatus here. I'm not drinking this week. And then by Wednesday, I'm feeling better, and I think, well, probably overreacted. I think it's okay to go back in the water again. I know, I see the fins too, but I really don't think there'll be a shark attack today. You know, maybe you, but not me. God. Then they go on to say, the great fact is we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences, and those experiences have revolutionized the way we see everything. You, my circumstances, the world, the universe, everything. And I'm going, you're kidding me. I have a drinking problem. And they're saying, no, it looks like a drinking problem. But now you're not drinking, so what's the problem? I'm miserable. Silkworth describes restless, irritable, and discontented. I am miserable. I'm in pain here. This is not a friendly planet. I don't like it. It doesn't feel good being me. I am not comfortable. And the only thing that's ever worked for me is that. And until I change, that will be true. So that's the great fact. And the conclusion is that I'm hopeless until I have some kind of a conversion experience. You can call it a spiritual experience. You can call it awakening. You can call it a personality change. But it's going to be a radical upheaval in the way I see and respond to the world. Is it going to happen in an instant? No. I know a few guys that it has, but it didn't for me. It happened slowly over a period of time. Trial and error, trial and error, trial and error. So they tell us what we got with the doctor's opinion. They give us the prototypical alcoholic story with Bill. Then they give us a chapter on the solution. Seems to me the book should be over. They say, go find God. I don't believe in God. Well, that's a problem, isn't it? I'm a devout atheist. That's a bitch. That idea is going to have to change. And the reason it doesn't change is because I don't want it to. I cling to that old idea, even though it is of absolutely no service to me. It is no use to me at all, but I cling to it because it's what is known and it's what I've practiced. And you'll find that with all your old ideas when you get to it. So then they go, well, okay, how about more about alcoholism? Because they know if you read the book and study it, it's laid out in a way. They give you an idea, and then they repeat it 2 or 3 times. Then they call it a new chapter, and they give you the idea again, and they repeat it 2 or 3 times. It's all the same thing. If you don't change, if you don't find a different authority to reference, you're going to die. If you have alcoholism the way we see alcoholism, you're going to die. That's all you can do. You can either die or you can change. And by the way, you're powerless to change you. Have a nice day. See you next week at 7 o'clock. You know, Jesus. So, the idea they talk about that someday, somehow, I'll be able to control my drinking. Great obsession of every alcoholic drinker. Do I have that thinking? That's what it's asking me. Is this you? They're just saying, this is us. Is this you? And until I had someone walk me through this, I couldn't identify. Because I was busy identifying with everything that wasn't me. I wasn't in the army. I didn't go to war. I don't give a shit about money on the Wall Street. I'm not that guy. No, not at all. But when you compare the emotional landscape, I'm that guy. I get that. But until someone helped me with that, I didn't get it on my own. So then they go on and say, yeah, here's the deal. You have to fully concede to your innermost self that this is you. Not out here. That's baloney. Anyone can go to a meeting and sound surrendered for an hour. You know? Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I'm powerless. Oh, yeah, really. And the other 23 hours of the day, I was trying to convince myself I wasn't powerless. Because I was being a jerk. So, that's where the surrender is. That's where the recovery is. It's inside out. We surrender inside. We do the steps inside. It's an internal job. It's not an external job. It's not about finding the perfect sponsor or the perfect meeting. It's about doing the steps. It's about a process. So they give me all these chapters. This is the chapter they tell us to go try some controlled drinking or some controlled sobriety. You know, drink, stop abruptly. What does that look like? You mean like quit entirely? Stop abruptly, that's a radical idea. Stop abruptly. I do nothing abruptly. Well, I start abruptly. But stop abruptly, there's a concept. I was working with a guy once that was going to do some controlled drinking. And I said, fine, so let's set up. We got a calendar on the refrigerator. Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday will be 4 ounces of whiskey. You like 4 ounces? Yeah. 4 ounces will do. Okay. So we go and he checks off Monday, and he goes Wednesday, Thursday. He's checking off. He's doing fine for a couple weeks, and pretty soon he gets to Monday, and he borrows Wednesdays. And then he gets to Tuesday, and he borrows Thursday and Friday. And about the third week of the thing, the chart just went off. And there you go. There you go. Now you understand. You set the experiment up yourself, and you couldn't follow through. I think I'll try again. Oh, okay. Try again. Try again. If you think you should try again, I'm instructed in chapter 7 to say, yes, try some more. I'm not instructed to talk you out of your good idea. I think I can smoke dope and do this. You do. Well, have at it. I'll see you in a week. How are you doing that step work? Well, I've been so mellow lately. I really haven't had a problem, so I haven't felt the need. You know, it just goes on and on. Then it gives us this idea. What sort of thinking dominates a person that does that over and over? What sort of thinking? I never thought about my thoughts dominating me. What sort of thinking dominates someone that would do that over and over? I know better. I can handle it. I can control it. That's the delusion. Because all the evidence is to the contrary. All the evidence is to the contrary. And still, I will throw all that aside for this idea. It'll be different this time. I didn't always say it in those words. But there was always an extenuating circumstance. Well, it's Wednesday. You know, I lost my job. I got a job. Someone had a baby. Someone died. Got married. Got divorced. You know, broke my shoelace. Burned the toast. No toilet paper. Car wouldn't start. Car started, shit, you know, on and on. A million reasons. A million reasons. So, it never occurred to Bill, and it never occurred to Roger, and it never occurred to any of us that the problem was lack of power. My alcoholism doesn't let me see the problem. What it lets me see is what it wants me to think is the problem. If I could just get her to act differently, if I could just get him to give me a raise, if I could just get them off my back, if I could just get a new car, you know, if I could just get out of debt, if I could just catch a break, you know. But until I catch a break, I'm going to have a damn drink because it's the only thing that allows me to get through this crappy thing I call my life. It's the only thing that allows me to get up, stay up, and make it through the day. And until I have a substitute that works far in excess of that, I'm not going to take it, because it's the only thing I know. It's the only thing I know. Then they did something really used to drive me nuts. Jim and Fred, the car salesman and the accountant. Familiar with the stories? Nod. Yeah. And I would read those and I would think, what the hell is this? You know, they describe these guys and, oh, he's successful and everyone likes him and he's got, owns a car dealership and he's a war hero. And I'm thinking, what a son of a bitch. You know, he'd be right at the top of my list of people to have an accident. You know, and Fred's the same way. And I just couldn't get, I'm going, I don't have any of that stuff. I don't relate. But when I relate it from the story, you know, Jim was just a little irritated. But he blew it off. He blew it off. Had a little row with the boss, but not a big deal. Oh, by the way, I showed up for work on Tuesday. What happened to Monday? Tell us about that, Jim. You know, I called in sick. Whatever. So I'm Tuesday, I have this argument with the boss. No big deal. Just pisses me off a little bit that I work for the place I used to own. Not a big deal. Just blow it off. No, it's really not a big deal. I'm fine. I'm fine with it. I'm fine. I think I'll go out and sell a car. And I think I'll stop at that roadhouse that I've stopped at many times. And I think I'll just see if I can find someone to buy a car. And while I am, I think I'll have some lunch. And then it occurs to me, I think I'll have another lunch. This is when it starts getting weird. I had one lunch. That's fine. It's almost like he's waiting. He's almost like he's waiting. And then it comes. The thought struck me, you know, a little whiskey in my mouth. Now, there's a hell of an idea. You know, it took me two lunches, but I got there. I knew I was waiting for something, and the train pulled in. And the idea was, you know, a little whiskey in the milk, not a bad deal. That won't hurt you. Hurt me? Jesus, I drank for the effect. And now I've got this idea saying, no, you won't have any effect. This won't bother you. Oh, really? And so Jim's off the deep end. Fred, same deal. And he shows up in the hospital, little case of the jitters. Not a drinking problem, but he has a quiet little surrendering. He realizes, man, this is humiliating because I know the truth. I'm here because of my drinking. And by God, that's going to stop. And I have evidence in my life to comfort me in the idea that I can stop it because I've been so successful in every other area. So then these drunks happen to visit me. I think, oh, interesting. Nice, but run along. I'm not like you. I'm not like you. See, Jim and Fred weren't like us. They had other ideas about who they were and what they were. They didn't like our ideas, although some of them made sense. And so Fred goes out, has a perfect day. Now, Jim had a lousy day. We all understand drinking when we have a lousy day. Pissed off, I'm fine, I'm fine. Prick. Now, Fred had a perfect day. Fred had a perfect damn day. So he takes himself out to dinner. Thought crossed my mind. Cocktail. With my steak wouldn't be a bad thing, would it? Not at all. So he has a little drink, has his dinner. What does he do? He goes for a walk. I made this part up. The part that's coming. I imagine Jim, if I'm Jim, I'm taking this walk and I'm going, not a problem, just had a drink, not a big deal. Just had one drink. That's not a big deal, is it? No, it's not a big deal. We agree. Not a big deal. It's fine. We're okay, right? We're fine. Let's go back to the hotel. Okay. And then the thought comes back with a little more authority and says, you know, how about a nightcap? Good idea. Damn straight. Because we did have a drink with dinner. Nothing happened, right? So I used to have a nightcap. And the next thing I know, I'm giving all my money to some taxi driver in New York. God. You know, and I got some foggy recollection of talking to my wife who did not meet me at the airport. And I've got some friendly cabbie, which is a guy, I'm your friend until you're out of money, you know, driving me around. I'm on this run. I get done. And then he talks about being back in the hospital when I regained my ability to think. When I regained my ability to think, I looked back on that and the thought hadn't even crossed my mind. Because his whole thing was, thanks for the information, and I'll put up a good defense against that drink, and I'll be fine. Self-knowledge and resolve, very similar to Bill. But these guys were coming from two different, perfect day, lousy day. Doesn't matter. The thought is what took them both out. So they're trying to get me to see this thing about my thinking. So then we get to my favorite chapter. We agnostics. I mean, you know, in a sense, it feels it's hard to do this because we could do a weekend on any one of these things. So I feel I have the sense that I'm just rushing through this, but hopefully we'll make some sense out of it. The chapter to the agnostic is about the guy like me who felt he had no capacity for anything good. I had no capacity for love. I had no capacity for worship. I had no capacity for faith. None. None. And I really do not like the God idea. So they give us this stuff, and it's in the second chapter, or the second page. And they give us a summation. They're always doing this. They give us the setup, and then they say, this is what we concluded. What did you conclude? And then they tell you the answer to the question. Did you conclude this? Resentment leads on to futility? Did you conclude that? We did too. Oh, good. Well, move on. You know, if you didn't conclude that, well, maybe we should talk. So they get to this place. This is lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, period. So the question is it obvious to me? Is that idea obvious to me? Yes or no? Not kind of. Yes or no? Then it says, where and how are we to find the power? Well, that's exactly what the book is about. The main object is to allow the reader to find the power, and the power will solve his problem. So that tells me, when we get to 6 and 7, I am no longer my problem solver. Because when I solve my problems, I manifest more problems. That's my experience. Me working on me is more stuff happens. More not fun stuff happens. When I'm helping me, my life gets worse. So they put me in front of these questions, and they say, the main object of the book is to find the power, and the power will solve my problem, and it's singular. And I don't know for you, but for me, I had a lot of problems. I had more than one problem. You know, there was a drinking problem, but obviously I don't have that problem anymore because I haven't drank in several months. So that's not a problem. But I have other problems. I have the IRS. I have lawyers. I have restraining orders. I have ex-wives. I have kids I can't see. I have dealers looking for me. I have problems. I have cops looking for me in a half dozen states. I have several $1,000s worth of bad checks. I have problems. And once I get these problems handled, maybe I'll consider some of these steps. But right now, I got problems. And what this is saying is, no, you have one problem. Any idea that separates you from the solution. Whether your solution is the steps, or God, or Allah, or Jesus Christ, or Muhammad, or Big Wally, or the Creator, whatever, it's what separates you from doing this. Because the steps are the on-ramp to find the power. That's the program of recovery. So they put me in front of that idea. I don't know that. And then they go through and they deconstruct my thinking. Let's talk about love, worship, and faith. Oh, really? Haven't you loved anything? Well, love money. Love sex. I guess I love power. Yeah, okay. Well, what about worshiping? I don't worship. That's a church thing. No, what about worshiping? What did you hold above all else? Oh, being number one. Power over. My will. Intimidation. That was a good one. Yeah, that worked. Yeah. I guess I've worshiped a little. I love women. I worship them in a way. In a way. Oh, what about faith? Now there, I got no faith. Oh, really? No faith at all. None whatsoever. Did you not have faith in whiskey? Oh, good point. Never thought of it that way. I had complete faith in ethyl alcohol. I knew that if I put enough of her into me, I would be okay. I would be okay. I did have faith. Yeah, I did have some faith. Yeah. And I had some of that faith around some of the drugs I did too. But they weren't as reliable as alcohol for me. Alcohol was predictable to a degree. And so they deconstructed my ideas. about faith, love, and worship. And it was not a comfortable exercise for me. And it happened slowly because I was so well defended in my thinking about these ideas. But I had to admit, how about the God of reason? How about your intellect? Your ability to think your way out of all those problems. To talk your way out of getting your face smashed in. You know, to talk your way out of the ticket. To talk your way out of the angry husband chasing you down the alley. You know? Yeah, what about that? Okay. I'm with you. So then they talked to me about my senses. Sight, smell, taste, hearing, touch. My senses. What about those? I never considered this, but what they said was, you can't trust them. What do you mean I can't trust them? I'm quite aware of the fact that my armpits are sweating. I can trust that. I'm quite aware of the fact that I'm hot and I'm thirsty. I can trust that. But what about when that guy walks in the room and you decide what he's thinking based on his face? It never occurs to you that you're making up a story. It never occurs to you. You know, my senses are useful in a sense for my body. My autonomic functions are useful. They tell me good information, but they're not reliable. Case in point, your senses are telling you right now that this is the entire world. This square little room, this flat surface you're sitting on, it doesn't let you know that you're sitting on a globe that's spinning thousands of miles an hour and hurtling through space thousands of miles an hour in a more or less elliptical path around another object. Your senses don't tell you that. So I take my sensory data and I decide from the appearance of things what they mean, what's going on. And the truth is, if you've done a four-step, you'll recognize this right away. The truth is, I'm wrong most of the time. I am bloody wrong most of the time. And that's what's killing me, how I see the world. We're back to the thinking. Trust my senses to a degree, but not as the ultimate. I'll give you an example. Dennis, my sidekick, walks into the meeting. Hi, Denny, how are you? Doesn't say anything. I go, Oh, meeting's starting. I'll talk to him later. So all during the meeting, I'm looking at Dennis thinking, have I done something to Dennis? Have I done? No, I don't think I've done anything to Dennis. Did I not return a call? No. No, I didn't do. Did I offend him? No, I didn't. And then my head says, well, then Dennis must be an asshole. That's where we go. We don't go there in a leap, but pretty soon it's like, I wonder what's going on. Then my ego turns away and says, I wonder what's going on with Dennis. Because obviously nothing's going on with me. I've already looked at that. I wonder what's going on with Dennis. And then my head says, oh, he's kind of arrogant. Yeah, he's a little arrogant. And you know, someone probably ought to not take his inventory, but maybe a loving appraisal. Maybe a conversation, a little chat to let him know that his arrogance is getting out of hand again. You know, and now I haven't heard anything in the meeting because this is what's been going on in my head. Now we leave, and I don't go out to coffee because I want to go home and I want to think. And now I think about this all week long. And by the time I get to the end of the week of thinking about this, I think, when I see Dennis, I'm going to enlighten him. So I come to the meeting the next Monday, and I go, Denny, how are you? What? I said, how are you? He said, this ear's deaf. My hearing aid's in the shop. Talk into this ear. Oh, never mind. But it's the appearance of things, and I make up a story. I have done this my entire life. I don't have one or two of these stories. I've got tens of thousands of these stories. And just coincidentally, they're all about how I've been wronged. Go figure. They're all about what's wrong with you and how it's been hurtful to me. God, it's a tough place. No wonder we drink. It's not friendly. So we've got these ideas. We're powerless over alcohol. Life's unmanageable. Really? Where are you at with that? The doctor's opinion, these first four chapters are all about answering these questions. Are you powerless over alcohol? Is your life unmanageable? Do you now believe, or are you willing to believe, there's a power that could, not would, but could restore you to something useful. That's it. That's it. That's the whole deal. And that's, you know, that's why they say, if you reach this point now, we're going to make a decision. We are? What's that? We're going to decide to turn our will and lives over to the care of God. Right. Well, if you don't, if you're not there, toss the book or start again. Because you've obviously missed something. Or you're not one of us. So go find out if you're one of us. See you later. So here's something that's miraculous, I believe. Oh, wait a minute. Let's see if I can find this. I was blessed with this surrender that I had, where I didn't have any question about being powerless over alcohol. None. It was a great gift because I had problems with everything else. But I didn't have a problem with that, so I'm good on that. Now, what's this unmanageability? What is that about? Well, the secret underneath that is that you're powerless over running your life. It says, and our lives are unmanageable. I don't know about that. I'm managing pretty well today. Well, no, we're not talking about today. Let's talk about the big picture, the long view. Since you started drinking till now, let's look at that picture. There's a great set of questions on page 52 that you can take a guy through who doesn't think his life's unmanageable. Here they are. Having trouble with personal relationships? What would that look like? Mother, father, brother, sister, employer, employees, co-workers. Broaden it out a little bit. Banks, authorities, cops, internal revenue, personal relationships. Oh, couldn't control our emotional natures. What does that mean? Prey to misery and depression. Let's see. I think I can control my emotional nature, do you? That would imply that you can get up and predict your emotional whereabouts at any point in the day, really. So I get up and I decide today, I'm going to be peaceful. Today I'll be helpful. No. In fact, I think today I'll take from 10 to noon to work on my resentments. Just replay a few of the old home movies, get tuned up for the afternoon. You know, and then maybe from noon to 3, I'll practice some revenge. And then from 3 to 6, I think we'll go into to useful, helpful, kind. You know, no, I have no ability to predict that or even to construct it. I got up every day and said, I'm going to be a good dad today. And I couldn't. It's not that I didn't want to be. It's not that I didn't love my kids. I couldn't. After a point, I could not show up for my life because alcohol had been making all my decisions, very subtly at first, but much more pronounced at the end. So pray to misery and depression. Misery and depression. Oh, yeah. A little self-pity here and there, nothing bad. You know. But overall, I would give you a very cynical view of the world. The world sucks. That's what it does. It sucks. And the people that have some stuff over there, I used to steal a lot. Because I figured, Jesus Christ, Dayton's, they got money to lose. I should have some for me. You know, when I was a kid, I had a little theft ring. It was actually my first small business. And I had all these kids out stealing stuff for me over at the shopping center, and I would pay them with candy bars. Yeah, prey to misery and depression. Couldn't make a living. Feeling useless. Just a little. Just when I got sober. Just when I got a clear shot at what was going on in my life. And I just couldn't put it together. I just couldn't figure out why the hell I mean, I had guys I grew up with. And I'd run into them once in a while. And they go, what you been doing? I said, well, I've been on the road for 15 years. What have you been doing? Well, I went back to college. I got a degree. I got this little business over here. You know, people getting lives. And it was phenomenal to me. I'd look at it and I'd go, man, how are you doing that? Well, you're lucky. I'm not lucky. I'm not lucky. You're lucky. No, you work. I didn't do anything. I just pissed away years, 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 years. full of fear. I didn't know all that anger was fear. I was full of anger. And what I learned from the steps is my anger is just fear. Just loud fear. I think we might have talked about this last week a little bit. You know, I came in here being afraid of nothing, and I found out I was afraid of everything. That's an ego deflator. No kidding. So, couldn't be of real help to other people. It was really not a goal of mine, being of real help to you. But I would have to say that's true, if I wanted to help. But I really don't want to help. And the truth is, I was afraid. I was afraid to have any interaction with anyone because I couldn't predict what was going to happen. I was scared to death. You know, my deal, what I called relationships, usually lasted about 72 hours, about till she asked me what my last name was. And I thought, well, now that's getting a little personal. You know, just stay the hell away from me. And I wanted that closeness. I wanted that intimacy. But my ism, my alcoholism wouldn't let me. It's the same reason I didn't want to do that fifth step. Because if you know who I really am, you'll kick me out to the street. My biggest fear that I was unlovable. And I created that self-fulfilling prophecy. I was unlovable. And then I said, see, you're unlovable. And now you say, tell us all about you, especially the nasty, ugly shit. We want to hear that. Oh, really? And then what's going to happen? I know what's going to happen. You're going to say, man, I've seen a lot of people in here, but no one as bad as you. Don't come back here. Find another meeting, you know. Go somewhere else with this thing. So all they're trying to do is get me to get in front of this question. Are you alcoholic? Are you powerless over your alcohol? And how are you doing managing your life? And are you willing to believe in the possibility? The step says came to believe. That's past tense. It means in the course of time, some short, some long, in the course of time, you will come to believe that there's a power and it can do something useful in your life. So now here we are, crazier than ticks. And you know how crazy ticks are. But here we are, insane, going, you know, where's the recovery stuff? Where's the recovery stuff? Here's the first glimpse of a power moving through my life, my consciousness, my interior, that I could come out of what I came out of and make those conclusions. To get in front of that truth and say, that is me. That is me. That's miraculous. That's a shift in perception. That's an opening up to ideas that were totally radical. Powerless? Wow. Really? Never considered that. Got a lot of evidence now that you put it this way. Makes sense. And all of a sudden I'm going, yeah, powerless. I'm powerless. The other thing they don't tell you is you're powerless to manage your life as well. They meant powerless with a capital P. They don't anywhere in the steps say, well, you have some power over here. You do have some power at work, or you do have some power with your wife or your husband. You do have some power with a checkbook. It's a no. You have no power. And you better find a power by which you can live, or the prognosis for you is fatal. And we go, oh, yeah, fatal, procurable, incurable illness. It's only a spiritual experience. Yeah, right, fine. But we don't act like it. Rarely do we act like our life's on the line. We want to play. We want to debate. I almost debated myself dead in AA because I was insistent on this idea that I'm not an alcoholic. And, you know, I had my little awakening at gunpoint. Did I tell you that last week? No. How I took my second step? I didn't tell you that?
No.
The rest of you go, I don't know. I was sleeping, man. What are you? Jesus. Ed goes, no. And everyone else is going, I don't know. I didn't know there was going to be questions. Jesus. Well, I was about a year and a half into my happy, joyous, and free trudge. And I was going to meetings sometimes once, twice a month, whether I needed them or not, you know. And I would sit in the back, like the ladies there, not that you or me, but I would sit in the back of the meeting, go to speaker meetings, like those especially, didn't have to participate, didn't have to interact. No, I don't want to be greeted. No, I don't want a damn hug. Just, where's the coffee? And if you have a donut, that'd be nice, you know. And I'll get in late so I can avoid all that crap at the door. I'll sit in the back. I'll listen to some yahoo spew lies from the podium, and then I'll get up while you all are praying, because I ain't going to pray, because I don't believe in that. Okay? I didn't have a problem with the first step. I just had a problem with the other 11. And so I'm haunted. I am plagued by the idea of suicide. The obsession to drink was removed really early for me, but the idea of suicide was not. And every day I got up and it was just like Bill when he was talking in his story, you know. I cursed myself for being a wimp because I'm looking at the medicine cabinet. I got this poison I could take and this would just be over. Then the end of the day, he's dragging his mattress downstairs because he's afraid he's going to jump out the window. Just nuts. I want to die. I don't want to die. I want to die. I don't want to die. Oh, God. Why can't he kill me? I don't know. Let's not do that right now, you know. So I'm obsessed with this thing about killing myself. And physical sobriety with no recovery is hell. It was much worse than the last 5 years I drank. It was much worse because I kept getting more and more clear. It took a while before I could really see and hear things. And it took about a year for my hearing to come back. But I was pretty banged up, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't in a state of not being able, you know, I wasn't irreparable. And I was still working in clubs. I was still playing. And I was nuts. And my brain was all screwed up. I couldn't remember what I was doing. We'd go play at night, and I'd be singing songs I wrote. Been singing it for 10 years. Couldn't remember them. I'd put the lyrics on the monitor, and I'd be, you know, reading and singing. And then I get there, and I go, damn it, did we just finish the second verse? Is it time for a chorus? Or what? And the band is just watching me, because I might, instead of singing the second verse, I might turn around and say, take it. Might be solo time. It might, you know, and they were just going, God, I wish you'd drink, because you're much more predictable. And I thought my brain was broken. Now, that coupled with the fact that I've done no step work, and I've got all this crap getting bigger and louder. I can't go out. I can't answer the phone. I can't answer the door. I can't pay a bill. I can't make any money. Can't hold on to any money. I'm freaking uncomfortable all the time. If I'm sitting, I want to be standing. If I'm standing, I want to sit. If I'm walking, I want to be laying down. If I'm laying down, I got to get up and walk. And every day it's like, why don't you just kill yourself? And I go, because I'm a coward. So finally, I succumb to the idea and I put my pistol in my mouth because, you know, if there's tough guys in here, you know, tough guys always have weapons. Just a little caveat. When you run into someone who is bad, they won't have any weapons. You'll just look at them and go, oh, my God. You know, it's in the eyes. So anyway, I had my little pistol and I put it in my mouth. Now I'm still an atheist, so I can't have a God shot. I can't have an inspired thought. Can't be, you know. So this is how God talks to me. First thought, mighty small caliber. I consoled myself with the fact that there'd be a large exit wound. And so I got this pistol in my mouth. And the second thing that came into my mind was this kid I went to high school with, Patrick, and tried to kill himself with a shotgun. And he, when he pressed the trigger with his toe, he moved the butt of the gun and he blew the side of his face off. And he lived. Went through 12, 15, 16 reconstructive surgeries. He finally killed himself about 7 years later. But the thought was, you'll be like him. You'll wake up in the hospital, paralyzed from the cheekbones down, and one of those jerks from Intergroup will be at the end of the table, the end of your bed with one of those blue books going, do you want to do the steps now, Roger? Blink once for yes, twice for no. And the third idea was, and it was very clearly, it was, are you even willing to believe in the possibility? And from somewhere deep inside me, I heard a voice say yes. The gun came out, and the suicide idea went away. And that's when I took my second step. All it was required to be willing to believe in the possibility. I didn't have to sign off on anything. The reason they take so much of the text to work on these ideas is because in chapter 5, right where you stopped reading, they're going to ask us if this is us and if we want to make a decision to go forward, third step. So the reason there's not as much space dedicated to the other steps is because they've already sold you on the idea. Now we've got a process. You know, it's a suggested program recovery until you decide to do it. then it's not suggested anymore. It's not suggested. You're directed to do these things in this order, in this manner. And so I thought, well, there you go. I've taken a second step. That's a beautiful thing. And I don't feel much different. And there's nothing to feel different about. So I've come to these conclusions. Joe and Charlie put it this way. In the first step, I identify the problem. I lack power. In the second step, I identify the solution. Find a power greater than me. Wonderful. You feel better yet? No. No? I don't feel better. In fact, I feel worse. And the reason I feel worse is because I know what's ahead. Read the bloody steps. They're everywhere. They're on all the walls. I mean, look what they're going to do. Jesus. That's what they're talking to me about. Now, I know what's next. Make a decision. To do what? Turn your thinking and your actions to the care and direction of this power. Well, what'll that look like? You don't get to know. What do you mean I don't get to know? I just want a little taste. No, you don't get to know. Leap of faith. Trust us. We've done this, and it's worked. The book says that. These are the steps we took. These are the actions we took, and this is precisely how we took them. And if you can take them the way we took them, you can have the experience we've had. And if I don't take them the way they have taken them, then I can't possibly expect to have that experience. So this is the foundation for everything I'm going to do down the road. Well, how powerless do you think you are? You know, what do you think powerless means? It means without power. What is one of the fundamental harmonics in the first step? Hopelessness. That's not an upper. Hopelessness. God, if you're hopeless, that's a gift. If you come here and you're not hopeless, you're screwed because you think you know better. At some level, in some area, you're going to think, you know what? That's good for you, but it doesn't apply to me. I know better. When I can get to the point where I don't know Jack, that's a good place to be. And all these steps, especially the first five, are all about tearing down my thinking, my perceptions. The limitation in this is me. It's not my circumstance. It's me. The limitation, what they've told me in all these chapters so far, the limitation is in your thinking. And if you're going to continue to think from selfish self-centeredness, which we've concluded is the root of your problem, not your drinking, your selfish self-centeredness, what is the root? Nice metaphor. Root of the plant. It's what anchors it. It's where all the sustenance comes through. It's what informs the plant. The root of my problem is me. I'm selfish and self-centered. It's all about me all the time. What about me? What about me? What about me? What's in it for me? Me, 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 me. Mine, 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 mine. I. God. And it's killing me. And they're saying the only thing that can change that is this power. So in these early steps, this is a process of ego deflation. Emmett Fox talked about, see if I can remember this, four phases of spiritual transformation. One, surrender. We do that in the first step. Admission. We're doing that in 2 through 7. Restitution, 8 and 9. And the fourth phase is construction of a new life. Not a reconstruction. Not rebuilding what I had. Because what I had was inadequate. I don't want to rebuild anything I came from. Constructing a new life. And it fits beautifully with our steps. So I'm in the foundation. I'm laying the groundwork. So what happens if I just sign off on this stuff and I don't do it at depth? What's going to happen is I'm going to get down the road and I'm going to say, oh yeah, I took a third step. Mm-hmm. I'm on there. 1, 2, 3. That's me. Powerless. Unmanageable. I'm willing to believe. In fact, I'll go as far as I do believe. And yes, I've made a decision. Who knows that? Who knows any of those first three steps? The only person who knows is you. It's me. Because they're all internal. They're all conclusions of this mind. There are conclusions I'm brought to by the text, comparing their experience with my experience, identifying. Then I come to this conclusion. I'm brought there by their experience and these new ideas. And it's like, oh, that's nice. But nothing's happened. Nothing's really changed. My thinking started to shift, but I'm still a bad actor. I'm still a thief. I'm still a liar. I'm still a cheat. I'm still chasing around with your wives. I'm still doing all that stuff. I'm just doing it sober now. You know? Actually, I'm a little better at it sober. A little neater around the edges. But no. So leaving aside the drink question, they report to us why living is so unsatisfactory. And the reason it's so unsatisfactory is self-reliance is not sufficient. And they keep pushing us towards this idea, you're going to have to become reliant upon something other than you. And it will reveal, as it reveals to everyone, in its own way to you. It's just about the ideas becoming, when we use the word realized, how are we doing? We're pretty good. Okay. When we use the word realized, it means to become real. I realize that now. Oh, that means it's real to me. That idea is real to me. It's real to me. That I get it. I can't run anything. I couldn't manage a freaking cactus plant right now. That's the truth. I can't manage. Yeah. Well, it points to the necessity of finding new management. And I'm scared to death of this idea, turning my will and my life over to the care of God. Whoa, Jesus. If I do that, I'll be out at the airport in a robe with a tambourine. You know, or I'll be over in Botswana with a tuba. You know, Jesus, you know. And I used to bitch about that in the meetings, and the long-timers would get me aside and say, listen, kid, if it's God's will, you'll love being at the airport. Thanks. But what's my fear? My basic fear is change. Now, I can cop to the fact that what I'm coming from is of totally no use to me. It's unserviceable. My life doesn't work, and I don't work as a manager. I'm there. I'm down with that. But now you're saying, new manager, this God idea. What is that going to look like? And the reason I butt up against it, thinking I want to argue with it, is because I'm scared to death to change. It's not that I don't want to. I see it. I see it in people who have lives that work. I see it and I go, damn, if I could do that, if that could be me, you know, but I don't believe that way that guy does. Well, he didn't believe that way either. You didn't see him at the beginning. You're seeing him at 15, 20 years. Or she. My belief will come to me through the practice. The power will reveal to me through the practice. Of what? Of the steps. So every day, I'm powerless in October 11, 1978. I'm powerless every damn day. Every time I take back my will in any given situation, it always makes it worse. It might not be intolerable, but it's painful. It's uncomfortable. There's dissonance. There's a problem here. Oh, it's stress. It's stressful. Yes, it is, because I'm trying all of a sudden, in sometimes subtle, not too subtle ways, I'm trying you all to buy into my script of how things are supposed to be, and I'm right back to being the actor. If only you'd all behave, we'd all be better off. Just trust me. Drink the Kool-Aid and follow me. So I make the decision. All it is a decision. The action of that decision is the fourth step. And until then, your program's theoretical. If you've taken a third step, you ought to be reporting to me that you're working on your resentments. Period. If you're not, you're working on a fantasy. Because the only place it tells us to rest is after the seventh step, after the sixth step, it says, consider this stuff. After your fifth step, consider this stuff for an hour. Think about it. Have you left anything out? Where are you at with these questions? Where are you at with the first five proposals, the first five steps? Where are you at with those ideas? Powerless? Unmanageable? Do you believe? You're willing to believe? Do you make a decision? Yep. Now, have you inventoried? Have you looked at your resentments, your fears, and your harmful behavior, sex conduct, and harmful behavior to other people? Have you done that? And have you concluded that if you don't change, that's a futile, horrible, intolerable existence? If you haven't come to those conclusions, you're going to have a problem. So when I balk at the fourth step, it's not the fourth step. It's the decision I didn't make in the third step. When I balk at the third step, it's not the third step. It's the idea I have about the God idea, which all this begs the question, what is your concept of this power? And you have to have a workable concept. It has to make sense to you, and it has to be something you can interact with. It doesn't have to be fully formed. You don't have to give me a 28-page treatise on your concept of God. And it doesn't have to be like mine or anyone else's, but it has to be something that you're willing to surrender to. So that, for me, eliminates the Old Testament. I mean, it just eliminates the idea of a wrathful God, a punishing God. Okay, so that's your concept? You're going to turn your will and your life over to that? No, I'm not. Well, get a new concept. The AA is the only place they tell you you can do that. Get a concept that'll work, because your life depends upon it. But the church I grew up in, that's too bad. That might work for them. Might have worked for your aunt and uncle. Might have worked for your parents. It didn't work for you. Get a concept that works. And I promise you, when you get a concept and work and you start moving towards it, your life will look just like those people that have their own relationship with their God, regardless of affiliation. When you find someone who is living from the Spirit, they're brothers and sisters. I mean, there is no dogma. There is no theology. There is being and there is power, and it's evident in the way we treat each other. A good Buddhist, a good Zen master, a good Jew, a good Catholic, a good AA, when they talk about the living God in them expressing through their lives, they're going to have lives that look very similar in the actions and the outcomes, not in the dogma, maybe not in the methodology of how they got there, but the outcomes are going to be identical. You know what? I'm free from that old thinking. I'm free from that old life. I'm free. I'm not let go. I'm not turned loose. I'm free. It does not exist for me anymore. See you in a week.